Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com.
Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Healthcare Today from Waterbury. Very, very cold day, as I'm sure you know. Wherever you are, I hope that you are warm enough and safe. Speaking of safety, our topic today is going to be emergency medicine. Emergency rooms are where many people initially interact with the healthcare system, from minor ailments to life-threatening emergencies. Emergency rooms are open 24 hours per day, 7 days per week, and they never turn anyone away. They are a beacon of light for their communities. It has always been challenging to work in an ER, but never more so than today in the midst of the COVID pandemic. The medical care provided in ERs is constantly improving, and today we have several doctors with us who are going to tell us what they do and how they do it. I want to first introduce, by the way, I want to also let you know that our phone lines are open for phone call or text at 802-244-1777. If you have any questions for the doctors today or have had any experiences in emergency departments that you'd like to talk about, we'd like to hear from you today. Let me first introduce Dr. Douglas Nilsen from Springfield Hospital. Dr. Nilsen is the director of emergency medicine at Springfield. He went to undergraduate at Colby College. He did his medical school training at Northwestern University in Chicago and his residency training in emergency medicine in Providence, Rhode Island, at the Brown University Hospitals. Dr. Nilsen, welcome.
Good afternoon, Dr. Myers. Thank you for having me today.
Well, thank you for being here. Let's talk for a minute about Springfield. And Springfield is one of our critical access hospitals in Vermont. These are 25-bed hospitals that are generally found in the rural areas. They are Medicare-supported and treat patients and communities that otherwise would be have difficult time finding care without them. Even before the pandemic, nationally, we know that many of these 25-bed hospitals have been under great financial stress. A number of them have closed. We know that I don't believe any of our hospitals in Vermont have closed, but 2 years ago, Springfield was on the verge of closing and going bankrupt. There was a change in management as something of an intervention. And can you tell us now how Springfield's doing?
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Myers. We are we're doing pretty well. We've just announced that we're able to emerge from bankruptcy, so that is going to be some weight lifted off the shoulders. But of course, we're dealing with the bankruptcy issues at the hospital at the same time as dealing with the pandemic that we're all experiencing right now, and so that has certainly created some additional stressors. But we are certainly doing the best we can with what we have, trying to work in an austere environment with the resources that are available to us.
One of the challenges for the critical access hospitals is because they're in outlying areas and don't have some of the accoutrements and some of the bells and whistles that larger and support services that larger hospitals have, they do have trouble recruiting nurses and physicians and other healthcare providers on a permanent basis. So they often have turned to agencies that provide physicians and nurses on temporary basis, something called locum tenens, usually at a much higher salary rate than the permanent staff would have. And that's been a major cost factor for these hospitals. Now, your team is there now as a member, now hired by the hospital?
Yeah, so I actually work for a company called Blue Water Health And they are based out of Brunswick, Maine. And they stepped in just about 2 years ago now to take over care in the emergency department. They're a physician-owned and run organization that have about five contracts with various hospitals throughout New England, including Nantucket Cottage, Holden Regional up in northern Maine, East Boston Healthcare, as well as Midcoast Hospital in Brunswick. And I think one of the things that they have been able to bring in the time that we've been at Springfield Hospital is a fairly consistent group of providers. The company that I work for has a very good turnover rate. Very few of our providers leave. And I have a model of care, I think, that can bring a lot of high-quality providers out, particularly to rural settings and in the critical access hospital setting, so that the staffing from a provider standpoint has been quite stable. I think where the hospital and the ER is facing a lot of challenges right now is in the, on the nursing side of things, where right now a lot of the traveling nurses that we've reached out to look to hire are charging rates that are comparable to a surgical specialist physician, and that is creating some challenges for us at the moment.
You have worked in, obviously you trained it down in Rhode Island at the Brown University, you've been in medical school in a big city, Chicago. Tell us a little bit about what's different working in a 25-bed hospital from an emergency room perspective.
Yeah, and that's a really good question. So for about 9 years out of residency, I worked in a community hospital in southern Maine, about 35,000 patients a year, which is not on the large, large scale of things. But you know, what you have in an environment like that is very immediate access to a number of consultants sort of within your system. And one of the big challenges that I have found rewarding to work through is working in an environment where those specialists are maybe not as readily available, and to help patients sort of navigate the path forward to try to get them the access that they need for the specialty care in a safe and you know, effective way. And that for me, after some period of time working in a place where I could immediately reach out to, say, phone a friend, a consultant, a specialist, to weigh in on a clinical scenario. The challenge for me has been helping patients navigate that system where those specialists are not as readily available. In the larger systems, it's very easy to get input around a patient case and to work that patient within the system. And the challenges in a critical access hospital setting is that you're working in a much larger system where those specialists aren't immediately available or requires travel or getting a patient from A to B.
Give us some examples of a couple of situations where you might have to transfer a patient to a larger hospital in Vermont or to Dartmouth, for example, which is relatively close to Springfield.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And so you know, the specialists that we have, you know, almost always available to us at Springfield include orthopedics, a general surgeon, ENT, urology, GYN, but there are a number of specialties we don't have within our immediate system. So cardiology, for example, if a patient is having a significant, what we call an ST elevation, myocardial infarction, we need to facilitate getting that patient to a place like Dartmouth that has an interventional cardiac cath team that can help take care of them. And that's a fairly time-sensitive and urgent kind of scenario. That is one example. A major trauma would be another example where you have trauma specialists at a place like Dartmouth that we don't have locally. So our mission there is to move those patients quickly through, identify the life threats, try to stabilize them, and get them to what we call definitive care. That can be relatively straightforward. I think, you know, the grayer areas is where there's more nuance, and that's actually where I think a lot of our challenges lie, and in how to facilitate patients that are in those more gray zones.
But that just even stabilizing patients is important. And if Springfield, for example, was not there, the time to go to one of these other hospitals, even by EMS, would be longer, and a longer time until they were stabilized. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is. And I think that's one of the reasons the hospital's been able to get a lot of support from the state, is because they have seen us as a critical touch point for patients in the community. You know, the emergency room, like you said in your opening statement, is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so our job is to be able to take basically anybody for anything whenever they need it, and to try to help kind of navigate them to where they need to be, and to be a resource for that local community.
Do you have a physician 24/7 in the emergency department, or other people staffing it?
No, we do. So that's one of the models of care that that the company I work for brought, is that we have a physician in the emergency room 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the year. We're also supported by nurse practitioners and physician assistants that help with the volume. But somebody is always there. Our core group is about six physicians, about half of whom were specifically emergency medicine trained, and the other three are very experienced in the field of emergency medicine, but come from different backgrounds.
Well, if you'll stay on the line, we are going to come back to you, and we may have some callers who might want to ask you specific questions. I want to turn now to the University of Vermont Medical Center, which is our largest hospital, and I believe it's our busiest emergency department just in terms of absolute numbers. And today we have Dr. Mariah McNamara, who is the medical director of the emergency department, and Dr. Richard Bounds, who is now the director of the emergency residency program, which was started recently at the University of Vermont. Dr. McNamara went to college at UVM. She went to medical school at UVM, did a residency in emergency medicine at Harvard's Mass General and Brigham and Women's in Boston, and also got a master's degree in public health, an MPH at Harvard. Dr. Bounds went to the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore and did his ER residency at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome to you both. Are you both on the line?
Yes, we are. Thank you, Dr. Myers.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Myers.
That's terrific. Now, one of the features of University of Vermont Medical Center's emergency department is you are the only level one trauma unit in Vermont. Dartmouth, of course, on our just over the border in our southern part of the state, also is level one. And I believe Albany, which is further away, is level one. But for Vermont itself, University of Vermont is the only level one trauma. Can you tell me what constitutes a level one trauma unit?
Sure. So our level one trauma center is really a regional resource for trauma. As an academic tertiary care facility, we have a lot of resources available to us to be able to care for some of the most severe and complex trauma cases that occur in our region. And part of being a trauma center is that we participate in trauma care from the level of prevention and community outreach all the way through the emergency department and EMS systems when people get injured, through the inpatient units and on to rehab and recovery. So we've been a trauma center, a level one trauma center, since 1994 and have well-established relationships with our surgeons, anesthesiologists, and subspecialists who helped care for some of the most complex trauma cases.
What are the basic requirements to be a level one trauma?
So to be a level one trauma center, you do have to have all of the resources to be able to provide 24-hour, 7-day-a-week in-house trauma care. So we have our surgeons in-house at UVM throughout the day and night. And we also have rapid availability to care for patients with orthopedic needs, neurosurgical needs, and the ability to get into an open operating room in rapid fashion, generally within 15 minutes, so that when people do come in with the most severe injuries, that there is the capacity to be able to care for patients with those needs.
You also, I believe, have a helicopter now, is that correct, dedicated to your trauma center?
Yeah, we have a helicopter. There's a collaborative relationship with Dartmouth, right, that's been terrific as far as broadening our ability to care for patients who have air transportation needs. That is in combination with the ground ambulance resources that are really important in this region, especially when the weather is bad, as we all know that can be a challenge here in Vermont. But we do have both the air resource as well as the ground ambulance resource to provide critical care during transportation.
And you're also, and that also provides help and emergency assistance to people on the other side of the lake, correct, in New York?
Yeah, that's correct. So our catchment area does extend up into northern New York, and there are also air resources that are stationed in northern New York that transport patients from that region to UVM.
You know, what you mentioned, you can rapidly have all of the specialists involved, and sometimes within minutes. We hear about the golden hour, and we have for many years when it comes to trauma. That's in that first hour, lives can be saved. What does that mean, the golden hour, and why is it important?
Yeah, so when people are critically injured, there are certain things that are really important to address as rapidly as possible. And people may have heard about things like the ABCs, the airway, the breathing, the circulation problems. These are things that by learning first aid and by rapidly accessing emergency services that can be intervened on and actually can save lives. So it is really important, I think, especially in a rural area like Vermont, to have access to the educational resources for people to know first aid, to be able to identify when there is an emergency that needs intervention, and to also have our systems in place for calling emergency services so that we can get people control of bleeding, to help them with any airway issues, maybe it's oxygen, but to be able to assess those needs and get them rapidly to a center where they can get the care that they need.
Some of this concept of the golden hour really, I think, developed from wartime and military medicine. How much, just in general, of emergency medicine comes from military medicine?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I think historically, our specialty of emergency medicine really did grow out of some of the lessons learned in wartime medicine. Certainly addressing the most critical life-threatening needs first and performing rapid and effective triage is absolutely critical to our field, and that is something that we do every day. There is a triage process that's quite standard and fairly robust, and being able to train to understand, you know, what sort of things really do need to be intervened upon immediately and how to do that is really critical for the learning in our specialty.
Who makes those initial decisions when someone comes into the emergency department?
So when people do come into the emergency department through our ambulatory side, so if somebody decides to come in by car to the emergency department, they first meet one of our greeters or triage nurses. Our triage nurses are specialty trained in emergency triage, and they typically will take vital signs and make an assessment and assign a triage category. People who arrive by ambulance have that triage performed by the EMTs or paramedics that care for them on the ambulance. And similarly, they notify us of the impending arrival, and a triage decision is made at that point.
One of the biggest things that people, the patients encounter is sometimes wait times, particularly in really busy emergency departments such as the University of Vermont. How do you measure wait times, and what have you done to try and reduce wait times for people who are ambulatory and walking into the facility?
Yeah, wait times have been a really big challenge nationally in emergency medicine. We certainly have data that we continue to monitor constantly as far as wait times go, and have multiple quality improvement projects related to wait times. One of the things during our COVID pandemic that we have done to try to address this is we've actually separated out our triage into isolation triage and the non-isolation triage to be able to, from the very front door, try to protect patients as they're coming in and better space people out during this pandemic.
Do you have to assume, though, that almost anyone coming in potentially could have COVID?
Exactly. So that process of being able to rapidly sort through who needs to be in a room with oxygen first and be able to get them to the correct place within our department is really important. And so as we've seen during the pandemic, our numbers of patients who've been arriving in ERs has actually gone down a bit. But what we're seeing is that when people are here, the acuity or the severity of their illness has actually been higher proportionally than it was prior to the pandemic. And I think that does highlight, a need for people to understand that we are open and we do have resources available. We don't want people waiting until they get even sicker to come in when there's a need that needs to be met.
Absolutely. And I think that has been a concern. It was a concern last spring when the numbers in the ER, the hospital where I work, dropped to almost zero. Knew that people were out there getting sicker and they were just afraid to come to the emergency department. But I would support completely what you say, that if you're sick, you need to come, period, and you will be safe in the ER in regards to COVID.
That's right.
Let me talk to Dr. Bounds in a minute, and we may have to extend after the ad, Dr. Bounds. But you are the residency program director. I believe you're in your second year of this program. It's the only ER residency program in Vermont. Can you tell us a little bit about the history and why the university felt that it was important to establish this?
Yes, thank you. Part of the impetus for starting this residency program was really the expansion of the CARE network, the University of Vermont Health Network, where UVM Medical Center partnered and formed affiliation agreements with the other hospitals in Vermont and northeastern New York. And as they expanded, as you talked about previously with Dr. Nelson, sometimes at these smaller hospitals, it's harder to find enough physicians to staff those hospitals who have emergency specialty training, and it becomes challenging. So one of the things that our leadership here very intelligently built was the idea that if you build a training program in Vermont at the same time that the health network is expanding, you'll create a nice steady stream of young and excited, enthusiastic ER doctors coming out of residency training and ready to staff your hospitals throughout the network.
Now, how many residents between the last year and this year, how many total residents do you have?
We have 6 residents per year, so right now we have 12, and it's a 3-year training program, and so we're going to have this coming July, we'll have 18 residents, and we'll be at full complement.
Are you getting applicants from all over the country?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we got over 800 applications for those 6 spots this year. So it's very highly sought after.
That's terrific.
We're pretty unique here in Vermont in that we built this program, as I said from the beginning, with the idea that this is a program designed to provide both academic medical center training at the highest levels and the most complexity and acuity possible, but also balance that with rural emergency medicine and austere emergency medicine. So So this program is fairly unique across the country in that we provide a balance of both rural and high acuity academic emergency medicine, because as Dr. Nelson was saying earlier, it's a very different skill set to be able to care for patients when you don't have access to all of the specialty resources at your fingertips like we do here at UVM Medical Center. So this is a program that really balances out those two types of training environments.
We're going to come back, and I'd like to talk with you further right after the break. Again, I want to remind listeners, you can call us at 802-244-1777. Back in a minute. We're back with the second half of our show today on emergency medicine, talking to Dr. Richard Bounds, who's the director of the residency program at University of Vermont Medical Center and an emergency medicine physician himself. Dr. Bounds, in the three-year training that the residents go through, do they spend all of their time in an emergency rooms?
Oh, no, not at all. Actually, the emergency medicine residency programs across the country, the training programs involve a lot of time throughout the hospital. So in the ICUs, on the pediatric wards, with labor and delivery, learning how to deliver babies, with the orthopedic service, learning how to manage fractures, and even on the trauma service, learning from the surgeons how they manage trauma in the hospital. So the residency program here involves a first year where our residents spend a great proportion of their time, about three-quarters of their time, on various services throughout the hospital to establish a foundation of knowledge and skill. And then they spend more time in the emergency departments in the second and third year, once they've established that foundation of knowledge and abilities. And that's also when they start to rotate at our outside community hospitals. Our residents rotate specifically a good portion of their time at Central Vermont Medical Center, right outside Montpelier, as well as Champlain Valley Physicians Hospital in Plattsburgh.
You know, a lot of emergency medicine, particularly when it's not dealing with COVID, falls in the intersection between primary care and truly acute situations. And I've often wondered if it might help emergency department young physicians in training to spend at least a small amount of time in the community and primary cares to understand what happens in those facilities, in those offices. Of course, they do probably spend some time during medical school, but having some additional time in their professional training might be helpful.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That it's really valuable to work with our internal medicine and family medicine colleagues. The model for most of emergency medicine practice throughout the country in training is to spend time on the inpatient services and to see more the admission side of things. But our residents do learn a lot about intersections with the community through their emergency department rotations, as well as even rotating with our social workers and case managers and our psychiatry service. Working with patients who are suffering from substance abuse, mental illness, and those types of needs. And emergency medicine, like you said, it really, the exciting thing about it is kind of, some people say it's 80% primary care and 20%, you know, severe emergency care. The interesting thing about our field, though, is that you never know which 20% that is. So every patient that comes in, emergency providers are taught to always kind of think worst first, we call it, where you always assume the worst, but then hope for the best with your patients. And after a thorough evaluation and testing, oftentimes you find that there's no critical emergency that needs something right away, but it's always kind of exciting and interesting of a field to try to figure that out with a little bit of detective work that we do in the emergency department.
Well, thank you for your enthusiasm, and thank you for starting this program in Vermont, which I think is very, very important. I want to turn now to Dr. Todd Gregory, who's the director of the chief of the medical emergency medicine department at Rutland Regional Medical Center. Rutland is our second largest hospital in the state and one of the busier emergency departments as well. Dr. Gregory went to college at Middlebury. He got his MD at Albany Medical School and did his residency and emergency training at Christiana Care, in Newark, Delaware. Dr. Gregory, welcome.
Dr. Myers, how are you?
I'm good. So tell me this, what kind of person goes into emergency medicine?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that the really defining characteristic is an individual who really tends to run towards problems. And I remember when I was in medical school, I was rotating in the emergency department, and there was a trauma that had come in. And I was really struck by the way that the staff there, and this isn't unique, of course, to the physicians, it's a real team effort, how quickly folks responded and ran into the room to, you know, serve this person and help them. And I think more than anything else, that's the characteristic that really defines emergency medicine providers of all types, but certainly physicians. They really are folks who want to make a difference and are comfortable reacting when things seem rough.
Let me ask you this. One of the most difficult things for emergency department physicians is dealing with uncertainty. You have to make a decision whether someone's going to be admitted to the hospital or whether they're going to leave your emergency department that day or that evening to follow up with whoever they have to follow up with. Not only you're concerned about their health, but obviously medical malpractice concerns come into play. How do you deal with that uncertainty?
I think it can be difficult. You know, in my training, I had some really fantastic instruction. And, you know, what one of my instructors reminded me is that, you know, as long as you're trying to do the right thing for the patient, you know, sort of the malpractice concerns will always come second. And I really believe that that's true. And so I think to just provide a little more detail and answer to your question, you know, those plans tend to be, in many cases, very patient specific. Obviously, if the patient is very sick, has a heart attack or trauma, as Dr. McNamara was talking about, those courses are fairly clearly laid out and we know what to do. But in other cases, the types that you're referring to, it really requires a conversation with the patient, time to understand what their sort of social situation is, what their support system is, and really what their comfort level is with any plan that you develop. And that's something that I think is really important in community settings like Rutland and really throughout the state of Vermont.
In some ways, it strikes me that emergency department physicians and other staff are in the same situation almost as police, in that you tend to see people in their most difficult moments. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate assessment. You know, no one who comes to the emergency department is, you know, having their best day. And for many people, it is their absolute worst day. And, you know, what we talk about a lot is that everyone who is in the emergency department has a problem that's an emergency to them. And cases can really range from what appears to be fairly minor, but is very important to the patient, to those that are life-threatening. And it's our responsibility to, you know, treat everyone, not only medically, but provide them support emotionally and otherwise to get them through that.
Let's talk about some specific situations. And again, this is very general, even though we're talking about specific situations, but I'm sure that you have certain things that you do with each of these kind of cases, the certain steps that you initially take. Let me give you a scenario. 63-year-old man has been, over the past 2 days, has been having some intermittent feelings of chest pain or chest pressure. It started when he was shoveling snow in out in the cold weather 2 days ago. Seems to be getting worse, gets better when he sits down and rests. He comes into your emergency department. What are some of the first steps you're going to do?
Well, as Dr. Bounds mentioned, we all use sort of the same approach, and that is worst first. I haven't actually heard it worded that way, but I really like it because it rhymes. And so, you know, whenever anyone presents with chest pain, particularly associated with exertion, we always worry about a cardiac or heart source, and heart attack would be first and foremost among those, although there are other important diagnoses that we consider. And so we have a very algorithmized approach to those problems, early EKG, very intensive interview and assessment of the patient to sort of risk stratify them. And we really want to get as much information as we can up front to determine, is this a immediate life-threatening problem that we need to act on now, or is this something that we can sort of delve into more carefully to provide, you know, the best and most appropriate care?
And, of course, you have cardiologists who are on call that
we
you
do.
Can use.
I mean, I think the point that I would sort of make, and this has been touched on, you know, by Drs. Nelson, McNamara, and Bounds, is, you know, I think one of the things that I really like about emergency medicine is, first of all, you know, again, we have really great teams everywhere that I've ever worked, and that's a really amazing part about it. But we're all very committed to providing the best possible care that we can, you know, for patients. And so that really means being sharp, being focused, and the care that we deliver really depends on us as providers, you know, really from the moment the patient arrives. And so while we have specialty care that sort of may vary in terms of availability from one emergency department to the next, what you find is that most patients get treated in a very similar fashion, and that, again, requires a lot of assessments and work by the emergency team prior to any consult getting placed.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, and we probably will have a future show on emergency EMS, both land and helicopter, to hear what they do and how they do it, but they are an essential part of the team, and they often get life-saving treatment started immediately before you even see them. Let me ask you, all right, you have a 75-year-old lady who has been smoking for 50 years, unfortunately still smoking, comes in because she's been coughing more than usual the past several days, she's been bringing up more phlegm, just doesn't feel well, maybe has a low-grade fever, and is more short of breath. What are some of the diagnostic things you're going to do, and how can you help her in the emergency department?
Well, again, I think it's important just to stress that, you know, we always start with, you know, what's the worst possible diagnosis, and especially in this day and age, that very well could include pneumonia caused by COVID. But shortness of breath, while we tend to think of things like pneumonia or COPD, which is, you know, a likely diagnosis here, can also be caused by other things. And so we really always need to have our radar kind of up and working, because heart problems can also present with shortness of breath. And so in addition to focusing on the symptoms that patients and this patient in particular present with, we really try to not be too focused in our initial kind of assessment, and we really want to consider all of the life-threatening diagnoses, which, again, as I mentioned, could include a heart problem in this case, could include pneumonia, or, as with this patient, I suspect, might involve a worsening of, you know, lung disease from smoking.
What are some of the things you can do to help her?
Well, again, depending on the diagnosis, if it's cardiac, we obviously need to intervene as appropriate to treat that problem. But if it is respiratory and involves pneumonia, that would include antibiotics. And with things like COPD, we know that there are medicines called bronchodilators that can be really helpful. Some patients are sick enough that they need respiratory support in the form of a machine called BiPAP. And in some cases, we have to actually put a breathing tube in and put people on the ventilator until they improve. So the interventions can range from fairly minor and non-invasive to quite invasive, and we're equipped to do all of that in any emergency department in the state of Vermont.
All right. How about a 45-year-old lady who comes in with complaint of abdominal pain, some nausea? She's thrown up once, and it has occurred a couple of times, particularly after eating. But tonight is particularly bad, her abdominal pain. Where do you start?
Well, again, what we try to get a sense of is, you know, how sick is this patient who presents? And that is a fairly complex process, but one that occurs very quickly. And good residency training programs, experience really helps with that. And then, of course, we look for things that provide us objective information. What are the patient's vital signs? Does she have an elevated heart rate, a low blood pressure? Both of those might be indicative of something that we really have to worry about in terms of a life or limb-threatening cause. And once we have sort of reassured ourselves that, you know, those things aren't the cause, then we can really do a good history and try to figure out, you know, what's going on. Is this a gallbladder problem? Does this patient have peptic ulcer disease that has gotten worse? And again, once we have sort of focused on, you know, where we think we need to go in terms of diagnoses, we can confirm those with things like ultrasound, sometimes CAT scan, and also look to treat the patient's pain and the cause of their pain.
All right. We have, as we all know, unfortunately, a problem in Vermont with alcohol and drugs. We're not alone in that, but Vermont does struggle with that. How about a 60-year-old fellow who has been in the emergency department a number of times in the past? He's a known alcoholic. He drinks heavily, comes in with a alcohol level 2 to 3 times the legal limit when you test him in the emergency department. What can you do to help him?
So I think there are a lot of ways to sort of address that question. The first, of course, is, you know, is the patient suffering from complications from that acute event? Is the patient so intoxicated that he or she is, you know, not protecting his or her airway? Do we need to sort of intervene in a medical way? But substance abuse disorder, whether it's alcohol or opiates, is a huge problem in Vermont as well as elsewhere. And so, you know, I think the thing that we really sort of pride ourselves on in emergency medicine is treating every person, you know, as a human being, somebody who is, you know, someone's mom, dad, son, daughter, brother, or sister, and trying to get them to engage in a way that helps them make better life decisions. And that is difficult to do. Many patients are not sort of there mentally or emotionally when they're in the emergency department. And it can be hard to get them the resources that they need, even if they are. But certainly doing some counseling in the emergency department has been proven to be very effective. We have a program like that at Rutland. I know many of the other emergency departments in the state do. And we also have the ability to intervene around substance use disorders otherwise, both, again, through counseling and through medication-assisted treatment. So we really want to try to extend the care that we provide beyond the emergency department for those patients, so that they can make better life decisions and stay safe.
Yeah, you note that there's counselors and you do have social workers assigned to your emergency department. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right, how about a 30-year-old man who has been skiing up at Killington and had a helmet on but took a fall and had a brief loss of consciousness, comes in feeling nauseated and a bit confused?
Yeah, so we, as I believe you know, see quite a lot of that at this time of year. Again, these are patients that we receive as trauma patients and do a full assessment on to ensure that there's, you know, not more going on than what the patient sort of presents with, which in this case sounds like a knock on the head and, you know, maybe a little bit of a concussion. So there's a protocolized way that we kind of receive and again, assess these patients. Once we're sure that there's, you know, nothing else going on, then we try to figure out how best to address the symptoms that they present with. And so patients who present with, you know, mild, even moderate concussion, depending on their age and risk factors, often don't require imaging. They require monitoring. And then we need to make sure we have a safe, you know, plan for them. Sometimes they require admission. Sometimes not. And there are patients who have injuries that are more severe or risk factors that require us to do sort of more work to ensure that they're safe. And that can include a CAT scan of the head, for example, speaking to this case. I think one of the challenges that we have in Vermont with patients like this is many of them are presenting from out of state. They don't have sort of local resources in the form of family or friends. And so making sure that those patients are safe can be a little bit more challenging. And so sometimes we'll have to admit them to the hospital until their symptoms clear or hold them in the emergency department until a friend or family member can come up to get them, and help observe them.
What for you is the most difficult kind of case or patient that comes in the emergency department? What makes you the most anxious, if anything?
Well, I would say that there are a lot of patients that make me anxious. I think that's probably true for all of us. Mm-hmm. And again, that's really because we want to make sure that we're doing our absolute best for patients. And as Dr. Bounds mentioned, you just don't know when you see a patient whether this is someone who's presenting, for example, with what seems like minor abdominal pain, but might be having a heart attack, or otherwise. And so I think one of the big concerns is, you know, are you getting the full story? And sometimes that's difficult if patients aren't able to clearly communicate what's going on with them. They're intoxicated or, you know, have something else on board, perhaps have a head injury. Those are patients that I think we all worry about quite a lot. I think the other patients that we have a hard time with, especially in the state of Vermont, is are, you know, patients who have significant illness or injury that need to get to a tertiary care site like UVM or Dartmouth that we can't easily transfer because of weather. That's certainly nothing, you know, I didn't encounter anything like that in residency training, but we've had patients who are very sick, require a lot of attention and resuscitation that we can't quickly fly to UVM or Dartmouth because of weather. And so that's really anxiety provoking. We really worry about those patients. Having said that, we've done, you know, a great job, both at Rutland and collectively with, you know, with those patients. And that's a real tribute to the teams that we have.
You work, you've worked with Dr. McNamara, and I'm sure in planning meetings and with Dr. Nelson and others.
Yes.
Helping form a network throughout the state.
Yes, that's correct.
Which is why I think one of the advantages of A, having a small state, but B, having a state that's well run, frankly, as Vermont is. Dr. McNamara, let me go back to you for just a minute. What's the future for emergency rooms? Where do you see the next big improvements coming?
Oh boy, that's a really interesting question. I think that what I'm seeing right now is that we're really doubling down on our focus on community and what the needs are in the community to try to take more of a preventative approach and engage with some of our community partners to see if there are ways that we can be part of supporting patients that maybe do come to us but have some needs that are not being met. So, for example, housing insecurity, food insecurity, substance use disorder and need for connection to additional resources. All of these things we're putting more and more efforts into, and I think those efforts are going to be really important for the care that we provide and for being an important community partner through the emergency department.
You're really talking, too, about the intersection with primary care.
Absolutely. I think that the more connected we are as a system, we all have the same goals. We want to have a healthy, well community that communicates well and that can you know, share the resources that we do have and use them most efficiently. I think the more that we have connected, and I will say that over these last 9 months with COVID, one of the things that I've really valued is the increased connectivity that we've had as a system. I think that's going to be really valuable as we move forward for addressing other longer-term issues.
Well, I want to begin to thank, as we wrap up, begin to thank all four of our doctors for being on today, Dr. McNamara, Dr. Bounds at UVM, Dr. Nelson at Springfield, and Dr. Gregory at Rutland Regional. All of you are on the front lines, and as I said, in some ways similar to police, and you see people at their most difficult moments in life, and you provide comfort and healing and stabilize them and begin their care and save lives. So I want to thank all of you, and I hope we'll come back to this topic in the future, and we'll hear about new improvements as we move forward. I want to also let listeners know that next week we will be talking about the kidney, in particular chronic kidney disease, dialysis, kidney transplantation. We'll have a guest who's been through that whole cycle of difficulties, as well as one of the nationally recognized kidney physicians. So I hope you'll join us then. We've got a very cold week coming up, cold weekend, so please be careful out there. Stay safe.
Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, brought to you in part by AgeWell Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Westview Meadows, and the Gary Residence. Retirement living the way it's meant to be. Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com. Employee owned and locally committed. And Northfield Pharmacy. Pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. NorthfieldPharmacy.com.
The music for this program was written and produced by Armin Bayajian.